As a New Testament scholar, I'm skeptical of everything. So when you say Jesus is one who's broken through, I'm like going, did he? Like, is that true? What is that? And so even the question, Jesus as a mystic, I have to, what is Jesus a mystic? If so, what would I look for? How would I know that he was a mystic? And there were a couple things I decided not to do. If we're thinking about Jesus of Nazareth as a mystic, I didn't want to go to the Gospel of John, which is late and is quite mystical, and I think involves more other people's mystical engagements with Christ more than the mystical experiences of Jesus of Nazareth. Not entirely, but I made a decision not to go there. And I made a decision not to go so much into other people's mystical experiences of Jesus in the other Gospels, like the Transfiguration, walking on water, or even Paul saying, it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And that's definitely a mystical engagement between Paul and Christ. But it is not a mystical experience of Jesus of Nazareth. And I was really interested in whether we could figure out whether or not Jesus of Nazareth was a mystic. And complicating all of this was a piece of my own biography. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about that so that you can be properly skeptical about anything that I would have to say about Jesus. So... when I was in my early 20s, my kind of conversion into adult faith happened around a desire for a kind of opening up of reality. So a couple of things came together. One was I was a young mother, and I was very overcome with gratitude for that and had no place to put that. I just didn't know. This is an experience I had not expected to be as powerful as it was, and was a kind of opening into another dimension of reality. And then going along with that was just the sheer tedium of taking care of a young child. So, like, there's the amazing thing, like, this child, like, everything this child does is really interesting, and my house needs to be cleaned, and I'm not sure I'll ever brush my teeth again, and all that kind of stuff. So I was trying to put that together, and in the midst of that, into my own life, came a group of people. The nucleus were a group of Roman Catholics who were trying to live in a different kind of community life, and they were talking about ordinary mysticism, the mysticism of daily life. And that revolutionized my own life. Once I could see the smallest thing in my life as being somehow connected to the biggest, most transcendent reality that there is, that changed my whole life. And so that's why I look at Jesus the way I look at him. None of us can look at Jesus without coloring it with a ton of who we are. It's really hard for us to see Jesus of Nazareth. And the Gospels that we have are the witnesses of people to Jesus. It's not a first-person account, so it's likewise theirs. So I don't feel completely illegitimate in presenting to you the Jesus that I relate to. But it's important for you to kind of know what's coloring that. And in particular, there was a piece that I meditated on a lot in those days. It comes from the Bhagavad Gita, which precedes, it's older than the time of Jesus, so I like to think of it as, being something that could have flowed into Jesus' life, perhaps, or into mystical practices of people Jesus might have known. So this is the piece, and then I'll say why I think it reminds me of Jesus. A leaf, a flower, a fruit, or even water, offered to me in devotion, I will accept as the loving gift of a dedicated heart. Whatever you do, make it an offering to me. The food you eat, or worship you perform, the help you give, even your suffering. I am the same to all beings. My love is the same always. Nevertheless, those who meditate on me with devotion, they dwell in me, and I shine forth in them. And I see in the daily stories of Jesus exactly that. His offering of every moment to God, and then the life of God shining forth through what he does. And that became for me, you know, an aspiration for my own life. Could I attend to the little details of ordinary life enough that the meaning that's sort of underneath all of them could shine forth? I don't know if that's something I always had from the time I was little, but for my whole life I have felt as though, like, there's a hinge between everything we see. It's hinged to the huge thing that we can't see that is the pure love of God. And I think that Jesus was really able to live out of that. And I want to be sure I'm sort of going in order here, because I did think about the order of events. When I think about, like, what would be the signs of seeing whether or not Jesus looks like a mystic? How would you recognize a mystic if you ran into one? What kind of a life is witness to mysticism? I think about these things. So a certain fabric of life that includes contemplative practices and mystical experiences. So I don't really think of mystical experiences as happening just totally spontaneously and out of the blue to someone who did not expect that. Because I think God uses our commitments and practices as a way to communicate with us. And behind the lives of most of the mystics whose names we know are very specific practices. So in Jesus' time, we're going to look at a couple of these in a minute, but a life of prayer, sort of the disciplines of fasting, of almsgiving, dwelling in the scriptures, the times that he goes to the temple and offers sacrifice, the liturgical year of the Jewish community, all of those things are richly informing his life as a mystic. It doesn't happen out of nothing. And I think it's important there's that balance between disciplined practice and then the spontaneous eruption of a God whom you cannot contain. But they really go together. And these talks on mysticism are, for the seminary, a piece of our comprehensive wellness. And so I think it's important for us to think about the practices that go with some of these things that we're talking about. If we want to enter into them for ourselves, what little experiments in practice, what might we want to engage in order to have some of these experiences? So there's contemplative practice and mystical experience. I think when I think about the mystics whom I know of or have known personally, they seem to have a God's eye view of the world around them, and thus they have compassion for themselves and compassion for others. And I don't think you can do one of those without the other one. I think that how we talk to ourselves and how we talk to others are really allied with each other. And so I imagine that in the life of Jesus. And then I think that mystics are people who are attentive to the ways in which everyday realities in all their particular detail open up onto the eternal. And that everything has that possibility. So I've talked about that a little bit already. There's a quote that I ran into recently, and just really it so resonated with me. So it's from the a poet laureate of Connecticut, and I have his name on your handout, I think. Yeah, Dick Allen, from a poem, Rime Frost. And this is the line: words are to the eternal as darkness is to the light. And I think that describes the experience of mystics, and let me say what I think it means. I don't know what it means to Dick Allen. He didn't tell me. I read his poem. I said, I love that. So he could mean any sorts of things, but this is what it means to me. Words are to the eternal as darkness is to the light. That darkness gives us the measure of light. Darkness and light are very much not the same thing. They're opposites. And yet, if there's no darkness, you have no way of knowing the light. You wouldn't even notice that there was light if there were not the darkness. And it gives us something of the light's measure. And when we try to describe eternal things in words, the eternal, the transcendent God is just literally unknowable in God's self. But we put words up next to God, sort of as the measure of God. And they are not God. They can't go over into the light. They don't have the ability to do that. But they can come up kind of up to the edge. And I think the mystic chooses to be in a kind of darkness, a kind of unknowing, so that the light can be known, so the light can be, so that you can come up right to its edge and sense where the edge is and the shape of the edge of the light. So thoughts about that? Thoughts about anything I've said so far? I just want to see if we're all in the same place or what your questions are. I don't want to go further until I know if we're all in a canoe rowing together.
What came to my mind was the practice of mindfulness.
Yes, I think it's such an important mystical practice. Do you want to describe it? In case other people don't know what you mean?
Somebody who's very bad at it.
Humans are bad at it.
Practice, usually for beginners like me, starts with just attending to your breathing. And what you feel, not what you think, but what you feel. And then, who wrote Siddhartha?
Herman Hesse.
Yeah. In his describing of it, he says, start with your breathing and then attend to what you feel with your head or in your head's area. And then he works through the body for beginning exercise. Mm-hmm. But the whole project is to let go of concepts and attend to what you are feeling. The focus is being present to the present.
Mm-hmm. Without making stories up about it.
Right.
Yeah.
This is how the Quaker mystic Douglas Speer described prayer, as being present.
Yes.
Totally present.
Yeah.
And that takes a lot of practice.
It takes tremendous practice. And that's the same with coming before God dark, instead of coming before God with all of our words and our stories and all of that stuff, which takes up all the space and doesn't let God come toward us. Yeah.
I conceptualize Jesus in two roles here. But one is that he's part of the triune God and the witness of Jesus. And so, in that sense, he's not a mystic, because he is what the mystics aspire to. On the other hand, his bodily presence on earth came to save us. He died for our sins, but he also came to show us how to live. He who would follow me, let him pick up his cross daily and follow me. And so through the mysticism, I think he's giving us that path of how to approach God. Mm-hmm. And one more thing about the darkness, as Dave was saying, that I think it was St. John of the Cross, the Spanish mystic, spoke of God as the bright light that is so bright that we can't face it. And so we have his backs to him. And it's the shadows that are projected forward, like in the cave, that we see that we know God's presence. And so we're trying to experience God, to get closer to the light, as you were saying, through.
Well, it's this sort of impossible thing where God is unknowable, but we must know God. God can't be expressed in words, but we must use words. The light can't be known by the darkness, but the darkness must be right on the edge of the light for the light to be sensed at all. There are all these kind of opposites that we find in the experience. Another story I think about that makes me think of what mysticism might mean. Maybe this is going a little far away from Jesus, but we'll come right back to Jesus, I promise. So just have him wait for a minute. But there's a contemporary physicist who studies different dimensions, and she's well known for making physics understandable to people like me, English majors. And so she was in an interview on NPR, and the interviewer said to her, well, you're talking about 11 dimensions or 17 dimensions, and we just really know 4, the spatial ones plus time. And how do you know that these exist? Because you just said that we are embodied in such a way that we actually cannot perceive these. So how do you know that they're there? Great question. And she said, well, you're right. Our bodies are made in such a way that we literally cannot perceive these other dimensions, that we respond to photons and these others don't. I don't know what that means, but that's what she said, something like that. And she said, we have to back off, let them come toward us, and record the differences we notice, the changes that have happened because they came toward us. I thought, well, that is the experience of the mystic, and I think that's what Jesus is doing when he goes away. And in the Gospel of Luke in particular, he's off in prayer and often all night in prayer. And I think he's doing that kind of stepping back and allowing the presence of God to come toward him in a way that's perceivable, noticeable to him. So what I see in him are these marks that I talked about of someone who engages in particular disciplines. He engages in Jewish life, in the scriptures, in a life of prayer, in fasting. He has that God's eye view of other people and teaches us what that might be. You know, going from town to town, I often think, like, what did he notice? Because I feel as though the entourage with him, they're sort of involved in what's going on and who's got lunch and what are we eating, you know, and all that. Wow, Jesus is sort of noticing this person or that one, and often nobody else sees that but he does. He notices the details of daily life. And that, to me, like, that's what I would call the off-the-cushion residue of mindfulness. So a mindfulness practice happens, I say, on the cushion because I sit on a cushion, but, you know, that attention to your breath, attention to just your body, just the sounds of the birds, whatever you're using to try to structure it, or if you're really brave, the nothing. But the fruits of that are not there. Like, they are way not there. In fact, you can experience the fruits even if every day you sit and you just wrestle with yourself, which is basically what people do. I mean, some people may tell you they have ecstatic experiences, but those are probably like this much of it. Mostly you just wrestle with yourself on the cushion. But then in daily life, you notice things. You start to notice the world coming towards you, and it's heartache and it's beauty and all of that. You become more and more alive. And that's what I see in Jesus as he goes, wherever he is, he's noticing. And for me, that's the residue of his disciplined practice, is in how he relates to the world around him. And you can see that. And all of those stories, like the widow and the coins, the woman putting yeast in the dough, the woman sweeping, looking for her lost coins, I feel like those little daily events open up in another world of meaning because he's attending to them. He's paying attention to daily life, and it opens up for him. And then he lets it open up for us. So in the time of Jesus, from 100 years or so before Jesus, maybe it might stretch it to a couple hundred years before the first century, there was a mystical practice called Merkava mysticism, which is it's a way of referring to the visions of Ezekiel. And Ezekiel is a prophet from the time of the exile. And what's significant about Ezekiel is Ezekiel was presumably a priest, but in exile he can't carry out his priestly duties, and the temple has been destroyed in Jerusalem, and he has this terrific vision of God and of this chariot of God, and he also has a vision of the temple that's as present as though the temple were there. And that becomes, for people who want to engage in mystical practice, a sort of assurance that when you engage God in, I think that the people who really practiced it, they had lots of practices around this. For instance, fasting and being in particular postures and that kind of thing to provoke the mystical experience. But the assurance is that God is really present. Just as God is present in the temple, God would be present. You're sort of like making your own body a container for God, your body being a temple for the Spirit of God to come into. So here's a little bit from the beginning of Ezekiel. In the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month. But look at that specificity. I mean, that's part of what I'm talking about with mysticism. It's not just sort of kind of floating all around, but look how specific he is about the day and the time. As I was among the exiles by the river Kebar, the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. On the fifth day of the month, it was the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiakim, the word of the Lord came to the priest Ezekiel, son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Kebar, and the hand of the Lord was on him there. As I looked, a stormy wind came out of the north, a great cloud with brightness around it and fire flashing forth continually. In the middle of the fire, something like gleaming amber, and he's off and running. And it sounds so much like Revelation, because Revelation depends on Ezekiel for a lot of its imagery. But there's that beautiful combination of this specific time and place, this political situation, and then this vision of the presence of God. And then the vision of the temple begins late in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 40. In the 25th year of our exile, at the beginning of the year, on the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year, after the city was struck down, on that very day, the hand of the Lord was upon me, and he brought me there. He brought me in visions of God to the land of Israel and set me down upon a very high mountain on which was a structure like a city to the south. And then he begins to, in for chapter after chapter, he describes in great detail the temple as his own body is essentially becoming the temple. So one supposition that some people have had is that Jesus knows of practices like that, and that the early Christian community was familiar with practices like that, and that that informs some of what they're saying and doing. So let's look at Mark 1. I think that's on your sheet. And then we'll look at 2 Corinthians. But let's look at the baptism of Jesus. But for me, like, this is the signature, is Jesus a mystic or not? This would be my signature piece to go to the baptism. So imagine, you know, if we're going to have to imagine the background on this. So Jesus was probably a follower of John the Baptist. And that's why the Gospels have to sort out for people who's the real one. Is it Jesus or John the Baptist? And every one of the Gospels says, it has John the Baptist saying, no, 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 I am not the one, he is the one. And, but so Jesus goes out to the Jordan to be baptized by John. And the significance of the Jordan is so important for us to grasp as a kind of political theater. Because just in the same way that Ezekiel talks about the political situation, this is a political context for Jesus' baptism. So think back to the original crossing of the Jordan at the beginning of Joshua. So the people have come through the wilderness, they've escaped from Egypt, they've come through the wilderness, they've received the Torah, and they're ready to enter into the land, and they have to cross the Jordan. Right? And when Joshua takes them across, Joshua has a spirit like the spirit of Moses. Moses has sort of anointed him to be his follower. And so actually the waters stand up on either side of them so that they can cross the Jordan, enter into their own land, and live by the Torah. Live with God as their king. That's the hope, is that when you cross the Jordan, you come into the land that is yours, and no one is over you but God. And you are willing to devote yourself to the things of God. So when John is baptizing people in the Jordan, it's not just the handiest font. It's a Jewish action with particular meanings. And, you know, people, there are mikvahs all over. If you just want to get people wet, there are mikvahs all over Israel that could have been used by people. But it's the Jordan. The Jordan is important because they're being baptized to come back into life. They're under the Roman Empire. It's a quite unjust system. They feel that they're oppressed. They're going to come back into it as though they are free people with only God as their king. And that's Jesus' program. And so he goes out to participate in that with John, and then he has this experience. So in those days, Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. And just as he was coming up out of the water, he saw the heavens torn apart. And literally it says like ripped, schizo. So imagine like the sound of paper ripping, like the heavens ripped open and the Spirit descending like a dove on him. And in there's been a really beautiful but very long and detailed book written about Jewish mystical practice in the time of Jesus that's called The Open Heaven. And this idea that heaven is ripped open, you can see what's up there, the heavenly realities, is a big piece of the mystical practice of Jesus' time. So he is suddenly having this mystical experience, but clearly he wouldn't even have been there if he were not a person engaged in practices of prayer and devotion. So I want you to see this combination of disciplined practice and then this amazing experience that happens. So he saw the heavens torn apart and the Spirit descending like a dove on him. And a voice came from heaven, "You are my Son, the Beloved. With you I am well pleased." Now in Matthew, the voice, other people hear the voice. But in Mark, Jesus is the one who hears this voice. So, voice. What if it's not a voice? How might you understand this story from inside your own experiences? Because I think we often think, well, I wish I were Jesus and I would hear the voice. Or, you know, I were one of those people in any number of those call stories, and God would just speak to me and tell me what to do. It would be so much easier, right? But I don't think that's what they're experiencing. I think he's putting words to the communication. But what has happened?
I think it's a knowing.
Yeah, kind of knowing. Like from somewhere. Yeah. And what it says is, "You are my Son." So, and sonship in the ancient world, it means, it's so Son, the Beloved, or the my beloved Son. So it combines both, I love you thoroughly, and you are my agent in the world. Because sons are the agents of their fathers in the world. They carry out the Father's business. And so, with you I am well pleased. His favor is for things he's doing. So there's both being and doing in this, I think, that are being both affirmed and encouraged and, you know, sort of recognized in his relationship with God. It's partly that he is so loved by God, and he's also the Son, the agent of God who needs to move into the world and live these things that he's experiencing. And all his ministry comes out of this. Yeah.
I really
find it inspiring, your emphasis on the mysticism of daily life, and that you have to have the contemplative practice,
right,
and that that's then linked to the mystical experience. But I guess I don't want to lose the grandeur and the transcendental aspects,
right,
of mysticism, even if I personally am not capable of having them. So I wondered if you might say something about that. Are you perhaps,
yeah,
suggesting that we should find joy in the process?
No.
Okay.
So I almost brought in one of my kitchen gloves, which is my illustration for this, because I think it's so important that these two realities are hinged, and both are, they're just equally important. So I tend to emphasize the small side, the detest side. But when I talk about the transcendent realm being connected to that, I'm serious about that also. And, you know, not just Jesus, but other people in his footsteps and other people across the globe have had these amazing experiences. What I want to say to people is, like, there's a lot of just daily showing up behind one of these. Like, these happen, and there's a lot, and they happen when you don't think they will. Who knows what his mind was on that day? You know, how surprising this was. Maybe John had been saying, yeah, you really ought to come out and do this, and Jesus would be going, yeah, when I get time, I'll come. And finally John goes, no, I really need it. You know, I'm going to be out there this weekend. You should come. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, okay. But, you know, who knows what the story was of the day he went. And then this thing happened. And all of his ministry spins out of it. I feel like it's those, did you ever get a surprise ball as a kid, the kind that you unravel? Like, it's just spooling out of this endlessly, this complete bathing in God's love and his sonship of God. And everything, every minute that follows this has its genesis in this moment. You know, that for me is in part what is breathtaking about Jesus, is his ability to keep on living that out wherever it went following that. I aspire to that, but don't get there. But thank you for bringing that up, because I think that's so important, like, to keep the two. So, oh, the rubber glove. I didn't explain the rubber glove. So, you know those kitchen gloves? Mine are purple on the outside, and they're kind of lavender or white on the inside. But at what point does the rubber become the other color? Right? Like, that's this came to me in a flash one day when I was thinking about this and how everything is both things at the same time. And the person sitting on the cushion and God are like, they're just like that rubber glove. You can just flip it inside out, outside in, back and forth, and you can't tell where one leaves off and the other starts. And I think that's really what people are witnessing to in the life of Jesus. Like, he didn't come with labels on him. There was nothing, like, he didn't have a t-shirt that said, I'm the Messiah. Like, people had to figure it out in the same way that I had to go, well, if he were a mystic, what would that look like? If he's the Messiah, what would that look like? And they're deciphering what they see. He looks like that. He has that life. And that's the manifestation. It's a real manifestation in the world of this relationship with God that he was willing to live out all the way. All the way. Yeah. Thanks. That was such a great question. So, I think, where do I want to go next? Oh, let's look at Paul for a minute. 2 Corinthians. I'm going to do something in a minute that I would probably tell anyone else not to do, but I'm going to go ahead and do it. I'm going to read a little piece out of a sermon. But before that, 2 Corinthians. So Paul is probably involved in these same sorts of practices that I talked about in Merkava or chariot mysticism. And he says, Of course, you know, he's concerned about his authority in this community, so he says, well, it's necessary to boast. Nothing is to be gained by it, but I'll go on to visions and revelations of the Lord. I know a person in Christ, so I have a friend who, this is like a very lightly veiled story about himself. I know a person in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. So there's that really that sense of going up to heaven in this chariot of prayer. Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And I know that such a person, whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. But there's that in the body, out of the body, those two dimensions of the experience, was caught up into paradise and heard things. And it's a terrible translation, that are not to be told. Areta remata. So remata are spoken words. Areta, unspoken, spoken words. that's again that darkness and light, the word and the transcendent. Unwordy words that no mortal may speak. On behalf of such a one I will boast, but on my own behalf I will not boast except of my weaknesses. So he almost sees himself as two people, one who has these amazing experiences and the other one who has these weaknesses. But if I wish to boast, I'll not be a fool, for I'll be speaking the truth. But I refrain from it, so that no one may think better of me than what is seen in me or heard from me, even considering the exceptional character of the revelation. I have to just love him. He's so funny. he wants to tell them about that. He doesn't want to make too much of it. So then he goes to what he endures in the flesh. And so again, the two sides, ecstatic revelations. And then, therefore, to keep me from being too elated, a thorn was given me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me, to keep me from being too elated. So then he goes on and talks about that. But clearly he's engaging in these practices in which he senses himself caught up. I mean, the fact that these practices are so well talked about, they have things like the third heaven, tells you that people are thinking about all the layers of ascent that you might have. This is the same period in which angels are important, so people thinking about all of the semi-material things that are between the material world and God. So the third heaven, thinking about the heights of things between themselves and God. So one more thing, then I'll go to decentering. So a colleague of mine started noticing the times in the Gospel of Mark that the verb anablepo is used. Anablepo means to look up. So I've given you the references here in Mark. You could look them up if you want. But Jesus, when he's breaking the bread, when he's feeding the 5,000, he looks up into the heavens. Other people ask that they might have their sight restored, so it can mean to have your sight restored or looking up into the heavens. The women look up when they come to the tomb. So it's interesting because we started in the baptism with Jesus looking up. It's not the same verb in the baptism, but looking up into the heavens. This may be a reference to this practice of prayer in which you imagine the heavens broken open and your ability to see in. And so several times Jesus does that. Other people do it when he heals the blind man. He looks up and he sees everything clearly. So it would be interesting to just sort of pursue that. I think it's a really interesting idea about a mystical practice. So in my last little bit, I guess, and then we'll talk a little bit more, I'm going to share a piece of this sermon, because in it I was trying to express something about the mystical life of Jesus without getting too mystical with my congregation, so keeping it within the realm of normal. But I think one of the important things about mystical practice is it gets you out of thinking that the me story, the story of me is the most important story happening. And I call that decentering. Like moving, instead of being at the center and all the rest of the world is around you, like shifting a little bit. So I imagine Jesus' experience in the wilderness as a decentering experience. And so this is about that. So I'm just going to tell that story. I'm not going to read you the whole thing. But it starts with one of the Little House books by Laura Ingalls Wilder. So Jesus, mysticism, Laura Ingalls Wilder, all these things. Like just about every other girl of my generation, I loved the Little House books by Laura Ingalls Wilder. I identified with Laura, who was willful and often bored with trying to be good. She had a little mean streak that I found appealing. But in those days, I was a glutton for plot. I tolerated the descriptions of the family's journey across the wide open prairie in their covered wagon, just in order to get to the places where something actually happened. But I had the opposite experience when I reread the Little House books many years later to my own children. By then, I was dumbfounded at the courage of Ma and Pa, setting out across territory where they would see no other humans for weeks at a stretch. The length of the day's journey was determined by the stamina of their two horses, Pet and Patty, of the dog Jack, who trotted under the wagon, and of Pa and Ma, who guided the horses, forded streams, and cared for three restless children. A particular passage has stuck with me since 1983 when I read it to my children all safe and snug in their footy pajamas and smelling of soap from their bath. So this is the passage from Little House in the Big Woods, I think. They had come in the covered wagon all the long way from the big woods of Wisconsin, across Minnesota and Iowa and Missouri. All that long way, Jack had trotted under the wagon. Now they set out to go across Kansas. Kansas was an endless flat land covered with tall grass blowing in the wind. Day after day, they traveled in Kansas and saw nothing but the rippling grass and the enormous sky. In a perfect circle, the sky curved down to the level land, and the wagon was in the circle's exact middle. All day long, Pet and Patty went forward, trotting and walking and trotting again, but they couldn't get out of the middle of that circle. When the sun went down, the circle was still around them, and the edge of the sky was pink. Then slowly the land became black. The wind made a lonely sound in the grass. The campfire was small and lost in so much space, but large stars hung from the sky, glittering so near that Laura felt she could almost touch them. So, while the wagon may appear to be in the center of the wide curve of the horizon, Laura and her family are clear that they are by no means at the center of concern of the universe. If the ice cracked as they crossed the frozen Mississippi, there would be no one to mark their passing. The shreds of the gray blanket on which Laura and her sister Mary sat every day in the wagon would signal to no one of all the life that it had witnessed. The Ingalls family was in some important ways radically decentered by their journey across the vast middle of North America. They are tiny figures against the endless grass of Kansas. Their human-scaled dignity and bravery and the faithfulness of their animals lived out against an enormous stage on which they can barely be seen. A few years ago, when I was driving back from Corpus Christi, I heard a radio segment about the International Dark Sky Association. The initiators of the Dark Sky Association contend that we are losing our sense of place in the universe by lighting the night so much that we can no longer see the stars. We think we're the center of everything because we've blocked off the nightly sight of something so vast and far beyond our control. So why did the Spirit lead Jesus into the wilderness right after his baptism? According to all the accounts, Jesus doesn't just make up his mind to spend some character-developing time in the wilderness. The Spirit practically pushes him out there. But why? I think it has something to do with the need we all share as human beings to be radically decentered before God can do much through us. So the Spirit leads Jesus into the wilderness without provisions to spend his days in the simplicity of wilderness and his nights under a sky full of stars, 40 days and 40 nights to be small in God's wide world. On the 41st day, the devil approaches Jesus with three temptations: to have the means within himself to satisfy all his human needs, to wield power over others by worshiping whatever and whoever will grant him that power, and to test God's care for him as a kind of miraculous parlor trick. In short, the devil tempts him with all kinds of ways to be invulnerable as a human being, probably assuming that a tired and hungry Jesus would be pretty easy prey. But in fact, Jesus has just spent a month and 10 days being radically decentered. He has spent 40 long nights under the wide stretch of stars, wondering what his place is in this vastness. Wondering, I imagine, what that rustling sound is behind that rock and whether it means him harm. He has spent 40 days living from the scant food and water that nature provides in a desert landscape, subject to all the forces that care nothing for one human life. I think we often imagine that by the time Satan comes to tempt Jesus, after the 40 days of lone journeying and hunger and thirst, that Jesus is at his weakest point. Surely he'll give in to the temptation of control. But consider this: perhaps 40 days of radical vulnerability and radical decentering have made Jesus stronger. He has had to find his place in a world that doesn't alter its patterns to assure his safety and comfort, that doesn't really care whether he's hungry or not, or weary, or questioning, or discouraged. He has had to find his place as a human being in a system of which he is a part. Such an important part, but not the whole. He has seen 40 astonishing sunsets and 40 sunrises so lovely that they defy description. Perhaps he's seen the ways of the simple animals, like those of our Texas hill country, so adept at thriving in this harsh environment, at making the most of every ecological niche, and the stars, infinite and bright against the deep sky, seemingly close enough to touch, as Laura Ingalls was to say, so many centuries later. No wonder that one of the other gospel writers tells us that Jesus felt that he had been ministered to by angels during his sojourn in the wilderness. In the wilderness, Jesus encounters and accepts the vulnerability of human life and finds his own true place in the universe, the place where all the fragility of his humanity meets all the dignity of human moral choice. This is our own true place, vulnerable and yet capable of being the means of God's presence on earth. From this place, then, Jesus of Nazareth embarks upon his active ministry as the instrument of God's healing power on earth. So for me, it's in that story that these practices come together. He's there, you know, the kind of fasting that he's engaging in the wilderness, the sort of attention to prayer, you know, that's the container. But then something amazing happens. Both the terror of the temptations, and all of the desert fathers and mothers will tell you about the temptations that come in the wilderness, but also the ministry of angels. And it's from that experience and the baptismal experience to me that this whole life of the incarnation really comes together and then spins out in his ministry. That always presence of God in the human, this as I say here, the dignity of human moral choice and our vulnerability, all of those opposites grow out of this both commitment to God and then the unspeakable, amazing thing that just happens that he can't control, that the God-sided response. So I think it's, you have like 4 minutes to say something. Maybe Sam, but let me just hold you for a second in case there's anybody else who hasn't spoken who wants to say something, ask something. Yeah, Dave?
I'm just wondering about when the disciples asked Jesus to teach them how to pray, was there anything special about that imagery of Abba, the image of God as Abba, or was that something that had been around already?
That's a great question. Yeah, people do like to hype that. I don't know. I should just say I don't know. But it does set up something for us. I mean, presumably that's a very friendly thing to call your father, your daddy. But that, you know, that prayer kind of puts together those two different dimensions too, doesn't it?
Like, and it's very decentering. So it really,
yeah.
It's like the ultimate decentering prayer.
Yes, yeah.
And I was also thinking of, do you think Jesus may have been raised by a mystic?
Well, if Mary is like the Mary of Luke, who finds out she's pregnant and doesn't say, "Oh, it's so cool, I'm pregnant," but says, "My soul magnifies the Lord because she is," then I think he was the child of a mystic.
But I am captured by your idea that what was around at the time of Jesus rather than reading back on through John.
Yeah, what kinds of practices?
That's why I was just wondering, you know. Mary was there, and Mary was
missing. Yeah, that's great. I'd love to say yes. And Sam? Is there another? Yeah.
I just have a quick question back on Ezekiel and God was visible, not in the temple. Is there a connection with that to like Celtic practices instead of standing crosses and then they have the houses of worship? And there's,
I don't know. I mean, I think there's a, like, you know, when you come to mystical practices, you come into like a basic human kind of relating with the transcendent. I won't even put the name God. Like, it's so basic that you would find it across so many different cultures. And that's one of the things that interests me so much about the attraction of mysticism and contemplative prayer right now. In Western society, Western culture, I hope it might save us because it connects. I think it has the possibility of connecting people. And, you know, it would be interesting. We could write it, we could say, well, in the year 2016, when this terrible political battle was raging and all this stuff happened, then, you know, 2 million people in the United States had this. Sat down on their cushions and had an awareness of God or something that transcended and that brought out their sense of compassion for themselves and others, and you know, like that, I would love to have that vision. So I don't know if there's I don't suspect that there's a direct connection to Celtic mystical practices or things, but it's a common human thing. I guess we can talk after. Okay. Thank you all
Jane,
so
thank
much.
Thank you so much. Yeah. We'll see you next week for our last lecture from Cecilia.
Yes, from Cecilia.